Hey folks, Sam Cedar here. You're listening to a free version of the Ring of Fire radio podcast. If you want the total show without commercials, head over to ROFpodcast.com and become a member of this program. Look, this is our main source of revenue for Ring of Fire radio, and you can help keep us on the air by signing up for a Ring of Fire podcast membership. For far less than a cup of coffee a week, you can support this program and get our full show. Head over to ROFpodcast.com right now and sign up. Much appreciated. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. On today's show, Middle East foreign policy expert Trita Parsi joins us to discuss why Trump's Iran policy is becoming dangerous. Branko Markaček from Jacobin Magazine will be here to explain why the sanctions against Venezuela are killing its citizens. Heather Digby Parton from Salon will join me to analyze all the big news from this past week. And the team of Katie Barrows, Ethan Miller, and Kylo Blado will be here to discuss their piece in the American Prospect, The Millenization of American Labor. If you're new to the show, you can find the free one-hour podcast of Ring of Fire Radio on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever podcasts are found. You can also, of course, become a member of the program by going to ROFpodcast.com. Get the full three-hour radio show, ROFpodcast.com, to sign up. Here to run down the biggest stories of the week, Heather Parton from Salon, or as you may know her, Digby. So, Heather, a lot of stories involving taxes this week. Not the lack of popularity of the Trump tax cuts, but rather literally Donald Trump's taxes. And this dovetails with a larger story about the broad obstruction and really constitutional crisis that we're starting to experience with all sorts of different Trump officials refusing to provide to Congress either testimony under subpoena, documents under subpoena, allow for Congress to have any oversight, and all of which, you know, we're no longer talking about breaking norms. We're talking about breaking laws. But before we get to that element of the story, and maybe this is a coincidence and maybe it's not, this week, the New York Times somehow got their hands on at least the top sheets, it appears to be, or the 1040 forms of Donald Trump's taxes for a 10-year period between 85 and 94. And it turns out that Donald Trump, on some of those years, was the literally the biggest loser in the country, like lost the most money of any individual in the country. What do you make of that? I mean, that it was a big piece. And my first when I first heard it, my first reaction was like, oh, this is, you know, this is creative of tax filing. But according to the Times, that's not the case.
Well, that's right. I mean, they go just to get back into back up a little bit and talk about how they got this. These are from they aren't the actual tax returns. Apparently, they are called tax transcripts. I didn't know something like this existed, but apparently they do, and they have been validated. The Times went and compared them to others that, and they did a very interesting forensic sort of detective work to ensure that these were actually Trump's real. They reflected Trump's tax returns properly. And there's some indication within the story that it's the same person, some, you know, accountant that did Fred Trump, Trump's father's taxes, that was the source of the information for the earlier big blockbuster piece about the Trump family tax avoidance scam that they had been into from previous years, going all the way back to the 70s. So this has been validated. And within the story, they do make the point, you know, that Trump and his people were saying that this was just, you know, it was a standard tax avoidance, process that people in real estate used during that period, and that there was nothing, you know, it was just what smart people do, as Trump said during the debates when asked, you know, when it was pointed out by Hillary Clinton that he hadn't paid any taxes. He said, well, that's because I'm smart.
So in other words, just to be clear, their defense is this is completely abhorrent. It is totally unfair, but it's legal, so I'm a genius.
Right. Okay. I'm a genius because I don't pay taxes and the rest of you stupid rubes do. That's essentially their defense. Yeah.
Right.
That's the best they can come up with. And I was more than willing to, you know, make it look like I had, you know, was the biggest loser in America just in order to pay taxes. I mean, this is, look, we know for a fact that his casino businesses went bankrupt. We know that his airplane company went bankrupt. There is a long, you know, trail of evidence that shows and has shown long before this came along that he was a failure as a businessman. This really isn't news to the extent that, you know, those of us who've been following Trump for a while, at least since he, you know, threw himself into politics, knew this, but this sort of lays it all out in stunning detail, and the extent to which he did it is beyond. Here's an example of what he did, just one example in the story that I think is really illustrative. He, for 2 years in the late 80s, he pretended to be a corporate raider, and he would go on TV and he would tell people that he was thinking that he was going to take over a company. And you remember corporate raiders, the whole, you know, it was kind of the Wall Street thing, right? The Gordon Gekko trip where, you know, greed is good. And they were these masters of the universe going out there and just taking a wrecking ball to American businesses and making big money doing it. And Trump said he was doing that, and he would go on TV or he would give an interview and say, I'm looking at this company and I'm thinking of taking it over. And, you know, all these stupid investors would jump on it and go, oh, you know, these are professionals, right? I mean, we're not talking about some guy in Idaho. He didn't know. These are professional investors in New York. Well, oh, my God, you know, let's get in on this. And they threw a ton of money at Trump during that period thinking that he was sincere about it. It took them 2 years to figure out that he had never done that. He never bought a company. He never did any. He didn't do any of these sort of, you know, fancy junk bond things or any of the kind of stock market shenanigans that were going on. He just said he was going to. I mean, it was one of the greatest cons ever. And that money, according to the Times, kept him afloat years longer than he would have stayed afloat. He actually, I mean, he blamed, you know, his downfall during that period, during the 90s, on the recession in the early 90s. It wasn't that. It was that, you know, he was just losing vast sums of money. And this con on the allegedly smartest people in America, right, you know, our great elites who run our financial system, they all fell for it. And, you know, let's not forget, they fell for it again in the 2000s. We know for a fact that Trump was, you know, going bankrupt over and over and over again with his casinos, and they kept loaning him money. It took them years to stop loaning him money, and that's, of course, when, you know, whatever the dirty shenanigans that he's been doing more recently with money laundering and Deutsche Bank and all the rest that the Congress is currently trying to look at, that's when that came in, because he couldn't get any more money from the standard, you know, investment houses and banks. But it took them years to get onto that. So Trump has it, you know, I mean, let's give the man credit where credit is due. He's the greatest con man in American history, and he rose to the highest level in the world, the most important job in the world, through utter dishonesty every step of the way. He is nothing. He is not anything like what he says he is. And every time he almost gets caught, he, you know, just kind of dances away and starts a new con. And, you know, I don't know if he'll get away with it this time, because he's kind of reached the end of the line, right? There's nowhere to go. But it's an amazing, amazing story. I mean, this guy fooled people for years. And yet, you know, I think you and I, Sam, the minute we saw that guy come down the escalator, or before, too, when he was doing the birther stuff, and any time we saw him on The Apprentice or anywhere else, we went, what a phony. I mean, I could tell, couldn't you? But
well,
these
yeah.
people
I
with
mean,
all
I
this
think,
money couldn't tell.
Well, I mean, to be fair, he was staked ultimately a couple hundred million dollars. And, you know, money attracts money. And,
more than that.
And you know, he did a pretty good job of hiding the fact of just how much of his success was owed to his father. And, you know, the reality
right, and
is...
And Dad did co-sign an awful lot of these
indeed.
Deals.
I remember Wayne Barrett, who was the late Village Voice reporter who reported on Donald Trump maybe more than anyone over those years, had said that every single one of those deals that he made in the beginning that made his name were co-signed by his father, that it was really the functional equivalent of, you know, a freshman in college moving to New York City and having their dad sign for their apartment. It doesn't really matter what other name was on the lease as long as dad's name is there. But it also, we got to take a break here, but it also, I think, you know, folks assume that a lot of money means intelligence, and in fact, mm-hmm. it does not, and this is just proof in the pudding. All right, quick break. I'm Sam Cedar at Ring of Fire Radio. I'll be right back with Digby. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar here with Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, in the last segment, we were talking about the blockbuster story in the New York Times that Donald Trump, over the course of a 10-year period, 85 to 94, was one of the biggest losers in the country, losing money 8 out of 10 years. And the attempt by the Trump administration to make it like, oh, well, Trump just did that because he was really good at basically screwing the country out of its tax money that was owed. When, in fact, it appears that he, in fact, just kept losing money, just a bad business deal after bad business deal. And many people kept financing him, much to the credit of those people who theorize that people with money are very often not very bright and have gotten extremely lucky. It sort of revives that that quote from Barack Obama, you didn't build that. And in many respects, it's quite clear when you see stories like this that that's the case. But, you know, we were saying at the break, it probably won't make any difference to Trump supporters in any fashion. There's no reason to think that it would. In fact, I saw some tweets this week to the effect of like, okay, so he lost all that money, but he won in the end. He became president and he did. You know, the only thing that I could say that, that may have some sort of material impact, coming out of this story is that oddly enough, Trump's own excuse, right? Which, and it appears to be false, but his own excuse that he was just doing what was, you know, was expeditious and most advantageous to him, gives more fodder to the argument that Congress should be looking at his taxes. I mean, here's a guy who right. claimed to be the biggest money loser in the country. Not close to it, but like literally the biggest loser in the country. And if there was ever a compelling interest in looking at taxes, it's how does a billionaire get away with paying no taxes? I mean, just take it on his terms. This, from a policy standpoint, gives a even more credence to the case that Congress needs to see the taxes. Now, the reality is, and you and I both know this, they don't need to have a compelling reason. They have the statutory authority to look at anybody's taxes. And but Steve Mnuchin came back, the head of the Treasury and said, well, I don't see a compelling interest. Ironically enough, the Trump administration has given them one, it seems.
Well, absolutely right. And you know, I can certainly see them going, look, we obviously need to do some legislation. You know, the argument they're making is, well, it has to be tied to some kind of legislative necessity to get the tax return. I can easily see, yeah, well, we think it's pretty obvious we have some necessity to look at the tax laws based upon what we've just heard from our president. So we need to see his tax returns, get an idea of what kind of loopholes that need to be closed here,
right,
if he got away with doing this. So that seems logical to me, but it's also, let's not forget, that law was put in place, the law that allowed the House Ways and Means Committee or the Joint Committee on Taxation to call for the tax returns of anyone, was based upon, you know, the what was happening in the late 1920s after the Teapot Dome scandal, and Andrew Mellon, who was the Secretary of Treasury at the time, and they were very concerned that Mellon was, you know, self-dealing with legislation and regulation and what have you with his taxes. And so they wanted to take a look at his tax returns to see if that was actually happening. And so that's why they wrote that law. Now, you know, I don't think we've had very many Treasury secretaries like Steve Mnuchin or Donald Trump, but maybe they ought to start looking at his tax returns. You know, Mnuchin, I mean, that's it to me with the way that he is behaving here, that he's opening himself up. That's what the law was written for, was to see whether or not, you know, the people in power were using the tax laws to benefit themselves. And, you know, they just passed this huge corporate, you know, and wealth tax tax cut on the wealthy just, you know, a year and a half ago. I think they have a perfect right. That under that, you've got this rich guy who admits to being a tax cheat. You've got Steve Mnuchin, who's covering up, and he's also another rich guy who's undoubtedly a tax cheat. I think they have, you know, I mean, it seems to me that you know, all of this admission, just as you say, has left them wide open to having, maybe Mnuchin too, to having both of them have the Congress look at their tax returns. They should, really. I mean, I have no doubt that the tax law has benefited both of those guys, do you?
No. In fact, it was widely reported that if you were in real estate, the S-Corp, the personal corporation pass-through cuts, were almost targeted to you if you were in real estate, as Donald Trump is. And so, yes, I mean, there's a lot of reason, and we're going to see that after this week. I think we're going to see this go to court, and I think we're going to see a lot of things about the relationship between the House in particular and the White House head to court. It raises, obviously, one of the big questions, and we will wait until the next hour to talk about this, but the question of impeachment. It still is the primary question that Democrats are asking, whether we're talking about candidates on the trail or whether we're talking about voters or whether we're talking about the leadership. And we will talk about that in the next hour with Digby. In the meantime, quick break. We'll be right back. Ring of Fire Radio. Coming up, Trita Parsi will join us to discuss Trump's latest moves involving our military and Iran. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. This week, the White House announced that the U.S. was sending an aircraft carrier strike group and Air Force bombers to the Middle East because of troubling and escalatory indications and warnings related to Iran, or I should say, so-called. Here to explain the president's decision, Trita Parsi, author of Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. So, Trita, we have spoken in the past about this very same issue of the U.S.-Iranian relations in the era of Donald Trump. And there has been, particularly in the last month or so, some new developments. Let's maybe start with the most recent and then work our way backwards to assess, or is it better to start with the designation of the Iranian National Guard in terms of their assessment, or I should say U.S. assessment, that they're a terrorist organization? What makes more sense? Because I guess implied in that question is, are we seeing steps to a plan as opposed to just simply random reactions?
No, there's definitely a plan taking place right now, being executed. And it's not Donald Trump's plan, it's John Bolton's plan. And John Bolton's plan for the last 20 years has been to start a war with Iran. And now he's probably in the best position ever to be able to execute that plan. He has a president that doesn't seem to understand geopolitics, doesn't seem to be too interested in details, and who has essentially delegated almost all of it to Bolton. There's no Secretary of Defense at the Defense Department that could put a brake on some of the crazy plans of John Bolton, something that Mattis actually did before he resigned or got fired. And at the same time, Trump has already bought into some idea of a maximum pressure on Iran. And within that context, Bolton is constantly selling to Trump more and more aggressive measures, all sold as being part of the maximum strategy, maximum pressure strategy, but in reality are now creating a scenario in which war is becoming increasingly likely.
All right. So, I mean, and maybe we should start with just to remind people that, and you literally wrote a book on this, or at the very least, you wrote a book on the predicate. Donald Trump unilaterally stepped out of an international agreement with Iran involving their nuclear capacity and assets that were frozen and sanctions that were imposed upon them. And my sense is that Trump, went in stepping out of that Iranian agreement that Obama had forged, that was less about a long-term strategy and more just simply responding to a Republican, a point on a Republican bucket list, as it were, and some sense of like, if Obama did this, then I'm going to undo it. But the addition of John Bolton has sort of furthered a specific agenda.
I think that's quite correct. I think Trump came into this only knowing that he hated the Iran deal for no other reason than the fact that it was Obama's achievement, and he was in it to undo everything Obama had done. But did he have a plan for maximum pressure strategy or a plan to go to war with Iran? I don't think so. In fact, I don't think Trump actually wants a war with Iran. I think this is something that Bolton is much more desiring. But as things have evolved, what happened was that the people Trump originally had hired were all in disagreement with Trump when it came to the Iran deal. Everything from Tillerson to Mattis to McMaster, they were not in agreement that the U.S. should pull out of the nuclear deal, and they saw a tremendous amount of negatives with the U.S. pulling out. He eventually fired all of them. And the only people he could hire that were in agreement with him about leaving the nuclear deal coincidentally also wanted to go to war with Iran. Well, and that's not a false link there. Those who were opposing the nuclear deal back in 2015, at least a very large number of them, were opposing it because they preferred war. And now the only ones he could get around himself to agree with him on this were also people who then were then starting to push him in the direction of war.
Right. I mean, maybe not so coincidentally, right, is the point.
Exactly.
It was coincidental only insofar as that Donald Trump has is sort of rudderless. His northern star in terms of these type of things seems to be largely a function of doing whatever Obama didn't do, but there are other people out there, obviously. So, okay. So, all right. With that said, do you think, or maybe we should go through some of the things that John Bolton, now that we have been living in a John Bolton era, and it hadn't occurred to me, but it makes total sense, obviously, that the absence of a defense secretary means that when we're talking about national security issues, John Bolton doesn't, there really isn't anyone who, I mean, is there anybody, is maybe Pompey, but is there anybody who is senior? I mean, to John Bolton, is there anyone in or around the White House that is capable or in, you know, the executive branch that is both capable of assessing what Bolton is doing, have the experience of sort of within the context of a bureaucracy like that, isolating Bolton and his bad ideas? And I guess the third element would be they have to disagree with John Bolton's desire for conflict with Iran. Is there anyone in the White House who is who fits that bill?
Not that I know of at this point. If they're there, they have managed to keep themselves anonymous to a certain extent, and that may not actually be a bad move on their part. But no, I think at this stage, it's this is a White House that is filled with folks who are very much going along with this. And the person who probably is the most known and who probably does have a different view is Trump himself. And that's not to give Trump any credit. I don't think he's against war because he's concerned about the humanitarian impact of it. I think he just thinks that it's something that would be bad for his base and the people who voted for him, who very much seem to view Hillary Clinton as being too hawkish. And remember, Trump was campaigning on the idea that the Iraq war was a mistake. And at first, he did not want to bring the neocons into his cabinet and into his National Security Council. But now he has, because there's so few other people willing to work for him. But the issue that really exists is that Trump's instincts that likely are against war are nevertheless secondary to his impulses. And his impulses are driven by a whole set of other issues. And if you have a very negative domestic situation for him, if you have the congressional Democrats calling in witnesses into Congress and the Mueller probe is continuing, etc., I don't see it as unlikely that someone like Bolton would be able to sell to Trump the idea that, hey, some escalation with Iran will change the headlines.
So, okay, this is fascinating. So we have this, there's this dynamic where Trump right now is shopping around for distractions, and John Bolton, who has a made a career of having a desire to get into a conflict with Iran, is opportunistically fitting this into what seems to have been, on his part, a plan. And let's take a break here. And when we come back, let's talk about the elements of those plan, including a terrorism designation for the Iranian National Revolutionary Guard and the expiration of waivers of sanctions, ones that expired in this past week and will expire in 90 days. And then let's talk about how it appears, and I want to get your take on this, that John Bolton is setting up a scenario where essentially he is building a context where war becomes almost putting war on autopilot in some respect. All right, we got to take a quick break. I'm Sam Cedar. We're talking to Trita Parsi. We'll be right back after this Ring of Fire Radio. Back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking with Professor Trita Parsi about the decision by the White House to ramp up military presence in the Persian Gulf. So Trita, in the last segment, you walk through this dynamic that exists now in the White House where we have a vacuum of power, but for, or I should say a vacuum of power within the executive branch, for or a vacuum of reason, as it were, in terms of our relationship with Iran. All of the people who were curbing Donald Trump's worst impulses to roll back the agreement with Iran and perhaps escalate further with Iran are gone. There is a vacuum, it seems to me, of power in terms of just institutional bulwarks against someone like a John Bolton, who is in there, who specifically has an agenda to go to war with Donald with Iran. And Donald Trump is a guy who, though he may not be inclined to get into a war because of domestic concerns, may not have the savvy to realize what he can and cannot get away with in terms of shiny objects that involve Iran. And John Bolton, it sounds like, is taking advantage of that. Tell me what the steps that John Bolton has taken, because I guess the only analogy I would have is it's like John Bolton is basically tying a brick to an accelerator in a car. And Trump is saying, yeah, oh, I got no problem with the brick on the accelerator, doesn't realize where that car is going to lead. And I think John Bolton has some hopes of where it will lead. Tell us what John Bolton has done over the past month or two to increase the likelihood of war with Iran.
Well, first of all, let's establish this. But Bolton and Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu have convinced Trump of is that if you go for a maximum strategy of pressure against Iran, maximum pressure strategy, the Iranians will eventually cave. They will beg for mercy. And that's when you, Donald Trump, will be able to get a much better deal with the Iranians than Obama got. And you can prove to the world that you are smarter than Obama. This is what Trump wants. He wants to be able to say, I got a better deal. Now, Netanyahu and Bolton, of course, know very well the maximum pressure strategy will not work. It will not lead to the Iranians becoming more flexible. On the contrary, they will dig in their heels. And eventually, it will become so bad that the Iranians may lash out, do something to increase the cost on the U.S. for pursuing the strategy, and then they can use that as a pretext for war. And if the Iranians don't, if they show tremendous discipline, which frankly they have done for the last year or so, and the U.S. has been outside of the deal and the Iranians have done nothing to provoke and have completely abided by the nuclear deal, well, if that happens, we'll just keep on pressuring them with more sanctions, and then we may even fabricate something in order to get a casus belli, in order to get a smoking gun. And something just happened in the last 2 days now. Important to mention that in the last month, you know, the U.S. has done something completely extraordinary. They have put the Iranian Revolutionary Guards on the terrorist list. This has never been done before, and it's going to be very difficult to undo, and it really closes a lot of paths for diplomacy and de-escalation.
Explain to us, though, how that works. I mean, my understanding is that it possibly allows for the administration to use the AUMF, the authorization for use of military force that was signed into law in the wake of 9/11. But what else does it do from a bureaucratic? I mean, what else does it do to ratchet up tensions?
There's a couple of things. First of all, it's very difficult to undo. So it's the U.S. in almost a permanent state of enmity with Iran, even if Bolton doesn't get his war. Because future administrations that actually may want to go back to the nuclear deal or actually want to do something constructive with Iran are going to have a hell of a difficulty doing so as long as the IRGC is on the terrorist list, because right. A lot of Iranian officials have a background to IRGC, and as a result, them would be designated terrorists.
Okay. And
moreover,
go ahead.
It can be used as part of the AUMF from 2002 and say that as part of the U.S.'s war on terror, the U.S. can start targeting IRGC in Syria or anywhere else. And by that, completely bypass any vote in Congress for starting a war with Iran. But something else has happened just in the last 48 hours, which is that a U.S. Warship has been heading towards the Mediterranean. And now Bolton issues this very unusual press release saying that it's going to go to the Persian Gulf and it's going to be in response to provocations to Iran, and that U.S. is ready to essentially strike Iran if those provocations continue. No provocations have been known. Nothing has been in the public. U.S. intelligence officers have been telling off-record journalists that, there's been some imprecise things and some intelligence, but they can't point to anything clearly. And then it is revealed that actually part of what this is based on is a report from the Israeli government, But the Israeli government did not come with any intelligence on anything that is about to happen, but rather they came with an analysis of what Iran might do. So let's take a step back and really realize what happened. The Israeli government provides a report of their analysis of what Iran might do. And John Bolton uses that as clear evidence that Iran is about to attack the United States and issues a press release saying that we're sending a warship to the Persian Gulf to deter Iran. This is what former folks in the U.S. government who have worked with Bolton have consistently warned about. His desire for war is so strong that he will take things like this and make up completely other scenarios in order to push the United States towards war.
Okay, and so we send this battle carrier group under false pretenses, essentially, or ginned up pretenses that Bolton has said that we're addressing some type of threat or some events that are happening or have happened or could happen. And so how does that, what is that in Bolton's mind? And if we're using that metaphor of like he's trying to put this on autopilot where the pressure will cause something to happen that will trigger a conflict. Like, what are the range of things that could happen when you have that carrier fleet in the near the Strait of Hormuz?
Well, you have carrier fleets near the Strait of Hormuz in the past. So the presence of it in and of itself is not something that, oh, this can trigger war. It's everything else around it that Bolton is doing. So, for instance, after all of this pressure, the Iranians are now really tired of the Europeans and others not really being able to live up to their promise of making sure that the nuclear deal survives. So Iran is the only country that currently truly is adhering to the nuclear deal. And they've just announced that by Wednesday, they may come up with reciprocal measures in which, because the U.S. has pulled out of the deal, because the Europeans are not buying Iranian oil, which they had promised to do, as a result of that, Iran is going to scale down its collaboration with the IAEA and its adherence to the nuclear deal. Rest assured, John Bolton will use that step as a provocation and say, well, the Iranians are pulling out of the nuclear deal. We have to take military action or we have to ratchet up pressure further. So he's trying to instigate essentially a cycle of escalations from both sides, which eventually will lead to war, even though that may not be the intent of Donald Trump.
It's fascinating. It's terrifying, too. I mean, people have to understand that Iranian politicians have, the same domestic pressures as any other country. I mean, they may be different in some respects, but they can't continue to sit and get broken promises and not respond. Trita Parsi, I have a feeling we're going to be talking more in the near future, but I appreciate your walking us through the goings-on at the beginning of this week. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Trita Parsi is the author of Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. When we come back, Heather Digby-Parton will join us to analyze more news from the past week. It's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Check out ROFpodcast.com to support the show.